Rumpole for the Prosecution by John Mortimer. Adapted by Richard Stoneman. Starring Julian Reintat as Horace Rumpole. As everyone knows, the second of the Rumpole Commandments consists of the simple injunction, thou shalt not prosecute. Number one is, thou shalt not plead guilty, and much further down the line is, never go shopping with she who must be obeyed. Having said that, let me try to explain how, in the case that came to be known as the Mews murder, I took the brief in a private prosecution brought by a dead girl's father.
I think I'm right in saying there's no time limit on murder. For the sake of justice. For the sake of my poor little girl.
Why don't I have a look at the statements and photographs while you, compose yourself. That's it.
Gregory Fabian was the senior partner in the firm of Fabian and Winchelsey, purveyors of discreet homes to the rich and famous. Slim in his early 60s, short but handsome, he had laughter lines around his eyes and the stylish elegance of someone who lived a good life and enjoyed every moment. Right up to the violent death of his daughter.
This is Veronica?
Yes, on her first day working for me in the office.
I could see that Veronica Fabian had been a large, rather plain girl in her early 20s. The witness and police statements told me she'd been beaten to death in an empty Mews house in Notting Hill Gate. Mm-hmm. I didn't understand what I could do in her defense.
This man, Christopher Jago, he was the main suspect.
They had him. The police had him, Mr. Rumpole. So why did they let him go, for heaven's sake?
That's what you want me to find out.
Yes, you're the man for the job.
Am I?
I've been assured you do this job far better than the usual sort of polite and servile QC.
I've read most of this brief, and I admit it's intriguing, but help me with some of the details, will you? The main suspect, Christopher Jago, he's a local estate agent, much like yourself?
No, hardly. He's a cowboy, always on the lookout for a way to cheat his clients.
I see he told the police that he'd noticed the for sale placards outside 13A Gissing Mews off Westbourne Grove and wanted to view the property. He rang your office and was put through to your daughter, Veronica.
She handled all our general inquiries.
Jago made an appointment to meet Veronica at the Mews house at 8:30 the following morning. When he got there, the front door was open.
If so, he claimed.
He went inside, expecting to meet Veronica for the very first time. I see from this photograph that the house was furnished.
The vendors had moved out, but hadn't yet removed their furniture, fixtures or fittings.
So, on the wall were a pair of spears.
There were African rugs, carvings and artifacts throughout the house.
Including the murder weapon itself. What do you call this?
A knobkerrie. It was used in southern and eastern Africa by native tribesmen. They threw them at animals or clubbed their enemies to death.
I see. 3 feet long with a heavy ball at one end carved from a single piece of hard wood.
Veronica was lying in the front room, covered in blood. Her head bashed in by that bastard.
Yes. Now, Jago said he knelt beside her body and tried to raise her head, which is why his cuff became smeared with blood.
He ran away. Didn't phone for an ambulance. Didn't phone the police.
Well, he said he panicked. He knew Veronica was dead, and he was afraid he'd be accused of some kind of sex killing. So he drove to the airport and flew to Spain.
Oh, yes. Just like any innocent man would.
Your daughter's body was found 2 hours later by a neighbour. The only clue the police had at that stage was the name she'd written in her desk diary. Not Christopher Jago, but Arthur Morrison, a man the police never managed to find.
Because he didn't exist. It was Jago all the time.
And his car had been seen when he parked it outside 13A Gissing Mews because he blocked a residence space. And she made a note of his registration number. When he got back to England, and he did come back pretty quickly.
Only because he knew he couldn't hide forever.
Jago spent a couple of days helping the police with their inquiries.
But then they let him go. Madness.
Well,
you'd have charged him, Mr. Rumpole, wouldn't you?
I'm afraid I am in the habit of believing everyone innocent until they're proven guilty.
But you'll take it on for us, won't you? At least, let a jury decide.
I'll have to think about it.
We've got to have justice, Mr. Rumpole.
Have we? But for whom are we seeking justice, Mr. Fabian? Use every man after his desert, and who should scape with him?
Ah, yes, Shakespeare, of course. But who? Othello?
As Gregory Fabian tried to place the quotation, I was thinking of the difficulty of having a client I could never meet. who I could never ask what happened when she went to the Mews house to meet this mysterious and vanished Arthur Morrison, or indeed whether she wanted such secrets as she may have had to be dragged out in a trial which could no longer have any interest for her.
Rumpole, I thought I might find you in your favourite watering hole, though not drinking water, I see.
I find Chateau Thames Embankment far more refreshing. Can I pour you a glass, Bollard?
Oh, no, nothing for me, thank you. Mrs. Plumstead doesn't approve of alcohol.
Mm-hmm. And yet you approve of Mrs. Plumstead.
We've been seeing quite a lot of each other. The possibility of marriage has even been mooted.
Really? When did you lose Mr. Plumstead?
He died 10 years ago. Mm-hmm.
Suspicious circumstances? Did Mrs. T do him in for the life insurance?
It's nothing to joke about, Rumpole. The poor man dropped dead in their living room.
Well, I'm sorry. I have murder on my mind merely because of a case I'm thinking of taking. But prosecution is not my line of country. Rumpole always defends.
Having said that, it wasn't long before events occurred which persuaded me to change my mind. First up was a visitation from one of Hilda's old school friends. Not Dodo McIntosh on this occasion, but a tall, horsey woman by the name of Charmian Dixon. It seemed her husband had just walked out of the matrimonial home, and Charmian felt unable to stay there on her own. She, who must be obeyed, offered her the spare bed in Froxbury Mansions, and insisted we all share the Friday night lamb chops with the soon-to-be-divorced Mrs. Dixon.
In the end, he admitted to bringing the little tramp back to the house, and I couldn't bear to picture them there, laughing at me, mocking me, Hilda, I'm quite sure of it, and so I simply had to stay elsewhere. Of course, I asked Dodo first, but she said she had people staying at the moment. I wasn't entirely sure I believed her, Aunt Renou.
Aunt Renou? Aunt Renou? That's not even a word.
Nicholas, don't be cheeky.
Will you take some wine, Charmian?
No, thank you, Howard. My husband was always drinking. 2-3 glasses of wine every night. Sometimes a whiskey before bed. Can you imagine?
Quite easily, yes. Aunt Renew.
Nicholas, you're a lawyer, Howard.
His name's actually Horace, but Mummy never calls him that, and I call him Daddy.
Nicholas, you be quiet. Howard, can I use my husband's excessive consumption as part of the divorce proceedings?
I'm afraid divorce isn't really my thing, but I can put you in touch with a colleague, Claude Erskine Brown, who will be happy to explain the law at great length.
Aunt Renew.
That's enough. Go to your room, Nicholas.
Go to your room, Hilda. Oh,
I mean it. No more supper for you if you can't behave like a grown-up.
I haven't finished.
Give me your plate.
No.
Nicholas.
I won.
Oh! Now see what you've done.
I'm covered in gravy.
Oh, yes, there you are.
Night, night, in the morning.
Night, night.
You haven't heard the last of this.
Can I put this dress in your washing machine straight away? I'm afraid it's going to leave a stain.
And I'm afraid we don't have a washing machine. I can pop to the basement first thing in the morning.
The basement?
There's a laundry room down there. 3 big machines and a spin dryer.
Howard, why haven't you bought your wife a washing machine of her own? Howard!
Sorry, were you talking to me? As Nicholas tried to point out, the name actually is Horace. But you can call me Rumpole.
Very well, then. Rumpole, buy poor Hilda her own washing machine.
She doesn't want one.
Well, of course she does.
They're terribly expensive.
Surely you can afford a small one, Rumpole. Hilda says you're always defending criminals in the Old Bailey.
Yes, that's true, but...
But defending criminals doesn't pay very well.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry.
As a matter of fact, I don't only defend. I get offered quite a few private prosecutions. They can be extremely lucrative.
Can they indeed, Rumpole? That's news to me. Just how lucrative, precisely?
200 guineas, Mr. Rumpole, and I've agreed refreshers at 50 a day. They promised to send a cheque down with the brief.
And it's the case likely to last a day or two?
Oh, if you want it, Mr. Rumpole, we've got it down for 2 weeks.
In that case, Henry, go out into the highways and byways of Oxford Street, order me the biggest washing machine you can find, and have it dispatched to Mrs. Rumpole at Foxbury Mansions.
So you are going to prosecute in the Jago case, then, Mr. Rumpole?
Well, yes, Henry. I thought I might try my hand at prosecution for a change.
My clerk declined a trip up Oxford Street, but agreed to ring round to find a good deal, then order a washing machine on my behalf. I passed on up to my room, where I lit a small cigar and reopened the papers in the Jago case, which I read with a new interest since Henry had dealt with the little matter of my fee. I looked at the rather sad photograph of the slightly chubby, slightly plain victim, and thought again how little she looked like her trim and elegant father. I went through the account of Jago's statements and decided that even the clumsiest cross-examiner could ridicule his unconvincing explanations. I turned the pages of Veronica Fabian's diary and learnt, for the first time, that she had had 6 previous appointments with the man called Arthur Morrison, and I wondered why the name seemed familiar. Then the door was flung open, and an extremely wrathful Liz Probert came into my presence.
Well, you've really deserted us for the enemy now, haven't you, Rumpole?
I haven't been listening to the news. Are we at war?
Oh, don't pretend you don't know what I mean. Henry told me all about it. You've gone over to the prosecution.
Not gone over, just there on a visit.
A visiting the establishment, the powers that be, yeah. The old Bill. Or just there on a friendly call? How comfortable, Rumpole, how cosy. When I was your pupil, do you know what I always admired about you?
Do remind me.
I admired the fact that you were on the side of the underdog. You stopped the judges sending everyone to the nick.
Yes.
You showed up the police. You stood up for the underprivileged. And now you, of all people, are being paid by some posh family,
yeah,
ritzy estate agents to cook up a case against a naff member of their profession. The narc he's been let free just because there isn't any evidence against him.
Let me enlighten you, there is plenty of evidence against him.
Oh, like the fact he never went to a decent public school like the Fabians.
And like the fact that he scooted out of the country when he found the body instead of telephoning the police.
Oh, I'm sure you'll find lots of effective points to make against Christopher Jago. You'll be able to argue him into a life sentence with a 25-year recommendation.
No.
Probably you'll get the thanks of the judge, an invitation to the Serious Crime Squad dinner dance and a weekend shooting at the Fabians' place in Hampshire. I don't know why you're doing this. Or rather, I know only too well.
Why do you think?
Henry told me. Just for a handful of silver he left us. One of your favourite quotations from your beloved Wordsworth.
Beloved, yes, but the quote's by Browning, about Wordsworth. It's called The Lost Leader.
The Lost Leader? Oh, well, that just about sums it up. No wonder you like your Wordsworth so much. Terribly apt, wouldn't you say?
All this was hardly complimentary to Rumpole, or indeed to the old sheep of the Lake District. It's rare for a criminal hack to be invited into his customer's home. We represent a part of their lives they would prefer to forget. The Fabians were different. Clearly, they felt they had nothing to be ashamed of. Indeed, much to be proud of in the way they were pursuing justice. Mrs. Fabian, it seemed, suffered from arthritis and rarely left their beautiful house overlooking the canal in Little Venice. I joined her and her husband in the high living room surrounded by tall bookshelves. The curtains hadn't been drawn, and Mrs. Fabian sat on a sofa looking out into the winter darkness, almost as though she was still expecting her daughter to come home early on yet another evening without a date. Mrs. Fabian was as small-boned and clear-featured as her husband, and yet they had produced a big-boned and plain daughter who had stumbled, no doubt unwittingly, on death.
Perhaps you could tell me a little more about Veronica, about her life, boyfriends.
Oh, that was the trouble. She didn't seem able to find one. At least not one that cared about her.
She worked in your firm, Mr. Fabian. What were her interests away from the office?
Oh, she read voraciously. She had an idea. She wanted to be a writer. She did some things for her school magazine, which were rather good.
They were very good.
She never got much further than that, I'm afraid. I suggested she came and work for us, and then she could write in her spare time. If she seemed likely to make a success of the writing, of course, I would have supported her.
Hmm. What did you like to read?
All sorts of things, mainly 19th century authors. She used to talk about becoming a novelist.
Her favourites were the Brontes.
Oh, yes, the Brontes. Charlotte especially. She had a very romantic nature.
This man, Morrison, whoever he may be, keeps turning up in the desk diary. No one in the office has ever heard of him. He's never been a client of yours?
Not as far as I've been able to discover. There's no correspondence.
You don't know any friend of hers by that name?
We've asked, of course, but no one's ever heard of him.
But in her diary, she seems to have had 6 previous appointments with Morrison.
We don't know everything. You never do, do you? Even about your own daughter.
Hmm. All right, then. What do you know about Christopher Jago? You must have come across him in the way of business.
Not really. He has, well, a different type of business. And he does it in a different kind of way.
What do you mean?
Well, He undervalues houses, gets the owners to sell cheaply to a chap who's really a friend of an agent. The friend sells on for the right price, and he and the agent divide up the profits.
The agent being Jago himself?
We've no evidence as such, but we've heard rumours.
Roger says he's a crook.
Roger?
Our son, Roger.
He works with me at the firm. Senior partner now.
And Roger says that Jago's a crook.
He's certainly a flashy type of operator, but that's really all we know.
Your daughter wasn't robbed. She hadn't been sexually assaulted. We don't think she'd quarrelled with anyone, and Jago didn't even know her. Why on earth should he want to kill her? The police couldn't answer that question either. Perhaps that's why they let him go. Thank you for the drink.
I'll show you out.
Mrs. Fabian continued to stare out through the window into the darkness of the night. I followed her husband down the stairs.
Did you have a coat?
Yes, yes, it's here.
Let me help you. As a matter of fact, Veronica is not actually our daughter.
Oh?
We had our baby boy, Roger, almost as soon as we were married. But then Evelyn found she couldn't have any more children, and we decided to adopt. Of course, we loved Veronica just as much as Roger, but now, well, it seems to make it even more important that she should be treated justly. There's always one child that you feel needs special protection.
It's going to explode!
Of course it isn't, foolish child.
No. Is the water supposed to be gushing out of that hose?
Oh, it's amusing.
I told you the plumber should have fastened it more securely.
Just scare the wind, Charlie.
I could see he was an idiot.
Should I fetch a mop or a towel?
Yes, yes. Get the mop, Howard.
Right. And where might I find one of those?
With no prospect of Charmian's imminent departure from our overcrowded mansion flat, I spent even longer evenings than usual in Pomeroy's. And I was not the only one.
What's that you're drinking, Erskine Brown?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's some kind of Sant'Emilio.
A whole half bottle, all to yourself.
Dutch courage, Rumpole. I have a meeting that I confess I'm dreading.
With an unappealing client, an obnoxious, instructing solicitor?
A psychiatrist.
A shrink? Really? Are you out of your mind?
Well, I don't think so, but Phyllida insists I have to get professional help.
Help with what exactly?
She said it's the midlife crisis. She said she'd stand by me, provided I went to see a psychiatrist.
Which you're doing tonight?
Oh, I've already been for one session. Philly fixed me up with a Dr. Gertrude Hauser in Belsize Park.
And what did Dr. Gertrude have to say?
She said the whole trouble was that I wanted to sleep with my mother.
And did you?
What?
I want to sleep with your mother.
No, of course not. Mummy would never have stood for it.
Really?
Well, quite honestly, Rumpo. Mummy was an absolute sweetie in many ways, but she was corpulent. I didn't fancy her in the least. And I told Dr. Gertrude I wouldn't have slept with Mummy if we'd been alone on a desert island.
What did Dr. Gertrude say?
She said, I shall write down fantasizes about being alone with his mother on a desert island. That's why I'm dreading tonight. All that talk about Mummy, it's really too embarrassing. She'd have hated it if she'd been alive.
Will you excuse me a moment, Erskine Brown? I must have a word with someone.
That someone being Liz Probert, who was sitting down at a corner table with a bottle of Plonk and two empty glasses.
I say, Liz,
how did you know about Christopher Jago?
You can't sit there and expect him David Inch.
Just until he arrives. How did you know that Jago didn't go to a public school?
He told me.
You met him?
Oh, yes. David just bought a flat through Jago's firm. Mm. We all went out for dinner to celebrate. I have to tell you, Rumpole, he was absolutely honest, reliable and trustworthy throughout the whole transaction.
According to Inchcape.
David was very impressed. That posh lot you're dealing with in Knightsbridge, Fabian and Winchelsea, were asking ridiculous prices compared to the one David was offered by Jago.
Mm. What else can you tell me? Does he have a wife? Girlfriend?
Oh, hundreds of girlfriends, I should think. He's rather attractive. Tall, fair and handsome. So don't ask me to give evidence for the prosecution.
Should I ask you to act as my junior?
Oh, you must be joking. And don't bother asking David. He's already been briefed for the defence.
He never prosecutes, does he?
He knows if he did, I'd never speak to him again.
Hmm. And I take it he's being led in the case?
By Sam Ballard, no less.
I'm against Soapy Sam. In which case, I wonder. Will you excuse me?
Off you go.
Claude Erskine Brown had yet to finish his half bottle of claret when I tapped him on the shoulder.
Erskine Brown, come and help me in the Muse murder. Be my hard-working junior.
Me? A junior? Go on, Claude. It'll take your mind off your mummy. I now had two contradictory views of Christopher Jago. One from the Fabians, one from Liz Probert. I decided that a little investigative work was necessary. And, having briefed my old friend and colleague, Ferdinand Isaac Gerald Newton, known as Fig Newton, I soon found myself back in Pomeroy's to listen to the debrief. As ever, Fig was suffering from his seemingly perpetual cold.
Oh, your suspect lives in a 1930s house near Shepherd's Bush Road, Mr. Rumpole, using the ground floor as his office. As you know, he's an estate agent. He drives a blue Alfa Romeo and is well known in the clubs and pubs made about in Notting Hill.
He buys and sells properties in West London.
That's right, sir. He's unmarried, but he's been out with a lot of girls. Pretty blonde secretaries seem to be his type. Receptionists do. But mostly one-night stands. Maybe a week or two, nothing serious. In the pub that he most likes to frequent,
which is
the Benedict Arms, Little Venice, the bar staff in there, they laid bets on how long each girl would last with Jago. Apparently, they all got it wrong with this one female companion of his. A big, awkward, pale, and rather unattractive young woman. Their words, not mine, sir. The staff all reckon she'd be another one-nighter, but Jago kept coming back to the pub with her. Half a dozen occasions, always talking quietly in the corner.
Half a dozen occasions? Oh. Of course. That's Veronica Fabian.
Is it?
Yes. And, obviously, he is Arthur Morrison.
Who is?
Jago. Jago is Morrison.
I'm not with you, sir.
Ah, I should have remembered. Arthur Morrison was an author, 19th century. Best known book was called A Child of the Jago. And with that realization at the forefront of my mind, I continued to prepare for the private prosecution that was shortly to take place in front of Mr. Justice Ollie Oliphant.
Mr. Rumpole, am I right in thinking you're here to prosecute?
That is so, my lord. I appear in this case with my learned friend, Mr. Claude Erskine Brown, for the prosecution. The defense of Christopher Jago is in the hands of my learned friends, Mr. Samuel Ballard and Mr. David Inchcape.
Well, I never. Members of the jury, Mr. Rumpole is going to outline the story of the case to you in perfectly simple terms, I hope.
I hope so too, my lord.
The defense will have its chance a little later.
And so we went to work. Christopher Jago sat in the dock. He was tall, 2 or 3 inches over 6 feet, with a suntan that must have been topped up by regular visits to Marbella. His hair was bouffant at the front, and at the back swept almost down to his shoulders. His droopy moustache and the broad bracelet of his watch were the colour of old gold, and his suit was electric blue. He lounged between two officers in the dock, with his long legs stuck out in front of him, affecting alternate boredom and amusement. Underneath it all, I thought he was probably terrified. I opened my case by describing the little Mews house as I remembered it when I went to inspect the scene of the crime. The cramped rooms, the chill feeling of the home unused, the African carvings and weapons on the wall. I asked the jury to picture the girl from the estate agent's office who was waiting in the hallway with the front door left open to greet the man who had telephoned her. Who was it? Was it Mr. Morrison? Or was that a name she used to hide the identity of someone she knew quite well? I took the jury through my theory that the literate Veronica had picked the name of the author of a book with Jago in the title. Then I waited for Ballard to shoot to his feet, as I would have done had I been defending, and denounce this as a vague and typically Rumpolean fantasy. I waited in vain. Ballard was inert.
Now, the defense will no doubt argue there's a real Arthur Morrison who met Veronica Fabian in the Mews and killed her before Jago arrived on the scene. No?
Once again, Ballard replied with a deafening silence. My instincts as a defender got the better of me.
That's what you're going to argue, Ballard, isn't it?
Oh, yes. if your lordship pleases,
It will be my duty to submit to your lordship in the fullness of time, and entirely at your lordship's convenience, of course, that the jury will have to consider Morrison's part in this case very seriously. Very seriously indeed.
If there is a Morrison, Mr. Ballard.
Yes, of course. If your lordship pleases.
My lord, members of the jury, we intend to call evidence to prove that Jago was seeing Veronica Fabian on a regular basis, meeting her in a public house called the Benedict Arms and having long, intimate conversations. The police decided not to charge Jago because there was no apparent motive for the crime. But if he knew Veronica Fabian, if they had some sort of relationship, they may have had to consider why he ran from that house where Veronica was lying dead and told no one what he had seen. Finally, members of the jury, it is for you to say why he lied to the police and said he never met her. You won't convict him of anything unless you are certain that the only answer is he must be guilty. And so we began to call the evidence. When I was defending, such witnesses presented a challenge, each to be lured in a different way, with charm, authority, or lofty disdain, to produce some fragment of evidence which might help the customer in the dock. Now, all I had to do was let them rattle on, and so prosecuting seemed a very dull business. Then we got to the police officer in charge of the case, who produced the fatal knob kerry, its end heavily rounded, still bloodstained, and protected by cellophane, as was the 3-foot black handle. Ballard, who had sat silently during this parade of prosecution evidence, showed no interest in examining this weapon, and said he had no questions.
What about the fingerprints? What about them? Jago's aren't there? Are they?
Of course not. There are no fingerprints at all.
Mr. Rumpole, I thought you told us you appeared for the prosecution. If Mr. Ballard wants to ask a question for the defence, no doubt he will get up on his hind legs and do so.
Chief Inspector Brush, let me put this to you. There are absolutely no fingerprints of Christopher Jago's on the handle of that weapon, are there?
There are no fingerprints of any sort, my lord.
I'm very much obliged.
Having swept that out of the way, Chief Inspector Brush, perhaps we could move on to what happened after you found the dead body of Veronica Fabian. You spent a good deal of time and trouble looking for Arthur Morrison.
We did, my lord.
In fact, Morrison was always your number one suspect.
He still is, my lord.
You don't accept that Arthur Morrison and Jago were one and the same person?
I suppose that may be a possibility.
And that Arthur Morrison is nothing but a dead author?
I don't know much about dead authors, Mr. Rumpole.
Even so. And whether or not Morrison actually existed, if you'd known that Jago had been meeting the dead girl regularly, would that have made any difference to the decision not to charge him?
Well, yes, sir. Well, I think he might.
Let us use our common sense about this, shall we? Jago told you he'd never met the girl. If you'd known he was lying, you would have charged him.
Yes, my lord.
Well, there we are, members of the jury. We got that clear at last.
There was one other question someone had to ask, and I couldn't rely on Ballard. Detective Chief Inspector Brush, you first questioned Jago because you had discovered that his car had been parked outside 13A Gissing Mews at the relevant time.
Yes.
You had no idea that he'd been into the house and found the body.
At that time, no.
So he volunteered that information entirely of his own accord?
That's right.
Was that one of the reasons he wasn't charged?
Well, that was one of the reasons, yes. We thought he'd been honest with us. We thought he was telling the truth.
I sat down, having made Ballard's best point for him. Of course, he had to totter to his feet and ruin it.
And so far as that goes, Chief Inspector, do you still think he was being honest with you about the way he found the girl?
Well, I'm not sure. If he was lying to us about not knowing the girl, I can't be sure about any of his evidence, can I?
I finished off the prosecution's case by calling my old friend, Professor Andrew Ackerman, with whom I have spent many hours discussing bloodstains and gunshot wounds. He testified that Veronica Fabian died from a heavy blow to the frontal bone of the skull, consistent with an attack by the knob kerry, Exhibit P1. I asked him if this must have been a blow straight down on her head, and he agreed, ruling out the possibility of it having been struck from either side. From the position of the wound, it was clear to him that the club had been held by the end of the handle above the victim's head and swung downwards onto the skull. I felt that this evidence was important, but at the moment he gave it, I didn't realize its full significance.
Call Christopher Jago! Christopher Jago!
No two characters could have been more contrary than Christopher Jago and his defense counsel. He was a bad witness, truculent, defensive, and flippant by turns. And Soapy Sam was finding it hard to conceal his deep disapproval of the blow-dried, shiny-suited giant he was defending. As I had called several witnesses who said they had seen him with Veronica in the Benedict Arms, Jago no longer troubled to deny it. He said he first saw her in the pub at lunchtime with another girl from Fabian's whom he knew slightly, and he bought them both a drink. Sometime after that, he saw her eating lunch in a corner, alone with a book, and he talked to her.
What did you talk about?
The ass selling business? Prices and that around the area? Oh, I didn't chat her up, if that's what you're suggesting. She wanted a sort of girl I could ever fancy, even if I weren't pretty well looked after in that direction.
So why did you meet her so often?
Well, just out and a bum into her, that's all.
It's not all, is it? Your meetings were planned. She entered 5 or 6 appointments with Morrison in her diary.
She wanted to see me, and we made a few dates and met for a drink and a Benedict.
Why did she want to see you?
Well, perhaps she fancied me. It's been known. I don't know why she wanted us to meet. You tell me.
No, Mr. Jago. You tell us.
She was a bit too scared to talk about it. She said it would mean a lot of trouble if we got out.
What was it, Mr. Jago?
She was worried. Worried about what was happening at Fabian's.
What did she say was happening at Fabian's?
She said they gave the people who wanted to sell their houses very low valuations. Then they sold to some friend who looked independent, but who was really in business with them. The friend sold on at the proper price, and they shared the difference. She reckoned they'd been doing that for years, on a pretty big scale, I imagine. Veronica knew I was in the same business. She wanted my advice. She hadn't got anyone else to talk to.
Mr. Jago, when you called at Gissing Mews that morning...
Well, like I told you, I was interested in the place for a client. I phoned Veronica and...
Yes, and you kept the appointment and found her dead in the hallway.
Yeah.
Why didn't you telephone the police?
Because I was afraid.
Afraid you'd be arrested for her murder?
No, not afraid of that.
Of what, then?
I thought she'd been done over because she told me what her father was up to. I thought that might be you, Christopher, if you get involved any more.
I wonder if I could ask the usher to pass Exhibit P1, the knob carry, to the defendant. Now, Mr. Jago, I have to put it to you that you and Veronica Fabian quarrelled that morning when you met in the Mews house. You lost your temper, and you took that weapon off the wall. You swung it up above your head.
Like this?
As he held the African club aloft, I realized at once that Christopher Jago was innocent. And from that moment, I was determined to get him off.
Get careful as you come into the house, members of the jury. There isn't a lot of room.
Can we hear, Rumpel?
So the jury can actually see the scene of the crime, Bollard. You should have requested this visit, not left it to me.
I really can't imagine it'll help my client.
Right, Mr. Rumpel, I think we're all here. What exactly did you want Mr. Jago to do?
I want him to hit me over the head with the knob carry, my lord.
Do you now? And can we all have a go when it's finished? I am, of course, joking, members of the jury.
Mr. Jago, would you be so kind as to stand in front of me?
What?
Yeah, that's it, that's it. Now, the victim's body was found beside the telephone. It says she was standing on this spot before she fell. So, if you'd now raise the club above your head, just as you did in court...
Oh, careful!
Oh, you've left a nasty mark on the paintwork.
Did you all see that, members of the jury? The ceiling is far too low for the defendant to lift the weapon above his head. Isn't that so, Bollard?
What? Oh, yes.
Very tall, the defendant. Very tall indeed.
It was my first prosecution, and I had managed, against all the odds, to secure an acquittal.
You got him off?
Yes. I was trying to explain myself to Gregory Fabian in his house in Little Venice.
Why?
Did you want an innocent man convicted? Stupid question. Of course you did. You said there's always one child who needs protecting, but you weren't thinking of Veronica, were you? You were talking about your son.
What about Roger?
What about him? Odd that I still haven't met the man. Why not? Are you concerned I might notice that he's a good deal shorter than Jago? I'm guessing, what, 6 inches?
I don't know what you're trying to imply.
Then let me make myself clear. I believe your son was undervaluing homes so you could sell them to your secret nominees. You accused Jago of doing that, but it was actually your practice. Veronica discovered what was going on and didn't like it. She asked Jago's advice, and I expect he told her to keep him well informed. No doubt he could make something out of it when it suited him to do so. Then I think Roger found out what his sister was doing. Well, she wasn't his real sister, was she? She was the much-loved girl who'd arrived after he was born, the child he was always jealous of. I expect he found out that she had a date to meet Jago at the Mews house. He went after her to stop her. I don't think he meant to kill her.
He didn't.
He lost his temper. They quarrelled. She tried to telephone for help and he ripped out the phone. That's how they found it. Then he took the knob carry off the wall. He's short enough to have been able to swing it without hitting the ceiling. Isn't he? You wanted Roger to be safe. You wanted him to be protected forever. And the best way of doing that was to get someone else found guilty.
I very much doubt you can prove any of this nonsense. You'll never prosecute my son.
It's not my business to prosecute. It never has been. I've told Henry to send your money back.
Poor Roger.
No, poor Veronica. You shouldn't have stopped her becoming a writer. I think she might have been rather good. I walked out of the house, breathing in the mist from the canal, glad to be away from a house silenced by death and deception. It was the night of Christopher Jago's celebration party, and I decided to stroll over to the Benedict Arms to join in with the revelers. As I drew near, reviewing the case in my head, I couldn't help remembering the closing remarks from Ollie Oliphant.
Mr. Rumpole, although brief for the prosecution, and under duty to present the prosecution case to you, members of the jury, took it into his head, no doubt because of the habit of a lifetime, to act for the defence. Mr. Rumpole will have to consider where his future lies at the bar, if indeed he has a future.
Those were the words with which Ollie sent the jury out to consider its verdict. It turned out to be a resounding not guilty for everyone except Rumpole, whose conduct had been, according to his lordship, grossly unprofessional. I climbed up to a celebration very unlike our chambers parties in Equity Court.
Ah, Bollard.
I hope that's not alcohol in your glass.
I thought I deserved a small T&G out of that exhausting case.
But you didn't do anything. You left it all to me.
That's not fair. I thought I handled the defense with a delicate hand on the tiller. And I got my client off the charge.
We got him off. By which, of course, I mean I got him off.
Mr. Rumpole, it's your clerk. This is urgent.
All right, I'm coming.
Here you go.
Thank you, Jago. Hello?
Mr. Rumpole, I've got an awkward situation here. It seems that Mr. Ballard arranged to meet the old baby matron tonight.
What, the widow Plumstead?
The very same. Trouble is, Mr. Ballard isn't here, and Mrs. Plumstead is. And I don't know what to tell her, because I think Mr. Ballard's with you, isn't he?
He certainly is.
Can you ask him to come back, sir?
Not a good idea, Henry. Soapy Sam is not entirely sober. And I gather Mrs. Plumstead believes he's teetotal. We don't want to ruin their blossoming friendship.
So what should I tell him, Mr. Rumpole?
Why are you asking me?
Well, I've heard you telling your wife some lovely little porkies when you've been stuck in Pomeroy's.
Henry, that's slander.
Maybe, but can you think of something I could say?
Where's the matron now?
In the waiting room, sir.
And then put me through to her without delay.
Hello?
Marguerite? Oh. This is Horace Rumpole speaking.
Horace! Are you with Samuel
Temple by any chance?
I am, yes. We're at a meeting of the Christian Lawyers Society.
Are you? Oh, I had no idea you were one of us.
Oh, yes, yes. Hallelujah.
Oh, well, why don't I come and join you?
Oh, no, I can't divulge our location, I'm afraid.
Why ever not, Horace?
It's top, top secret.
Oh.
We've had threatening calls from militant Methodists.
Samuel?
No, I'm sorry. He's far too imbued with the spirit to make much sense.
Oh,
he's talking in tongues, you see.
Oh,
he'll ring you in the morning.
No, Horace,
yes, no, bye-bye, Marguerite.
Horace.
God bless.
Oh.
That was your lady friend, Mrs. Marguerite Plumstead, on the telephone.
Good heavens. She's not coming here.
Nope. I gave you a perfect alibi.
Thank you, Rumpel.
I hope you'll give me something in return.
You want me to ring Hilda, give you an alibi?
No, I don't need one. What I do need is a little help with Mr. Justice Oliphant. Will you have a word? Ask him not to report me for being unprofessional?
I can try, I suppose.
Maybe not tonight, though. First thing tomorrow, if you're not feeling too fragile.
Of course. You've saved my life, Rumpel. It's the least I can do.
Just remember this. I've scratched your back, so it's time you scratched mine.
What? When did I ever scratch any part of you?
I was rather late home that evening. Quietly, carefully, I climbed into bed beside Hilda.
Is that you, Rumpel?
I'm expecting someone else to join you. Perhaps Charmian Dixon are having for a midnight feast in the dorm.
She's gone home. And good riddance.
I thought she was your second best friend.
She said rude things about our home. Called it a council flat. And she complained that you were always drinking.
How dare she?
I've sent the washing machine back.
Have you? Why?
Well, for one thing, it was Charmian's idea to have it. For another, I like going down to the basement. I see some of the ladies from the other flats there. We talk, we gossip. We complain about our husbands.
Yeah.
I can't do that by myself in the kitchen, standing over a leaky twin tub.
Of course you can't. Will we get our money back?
Some of it. Why?
I won't be paid for the Mews murder.
Oh.
I changed sides in the middle of the case.
I'm sure you did what you thought was right. But perhaps you might consider waiting a while before you do what you think is right again.
No. I can't promise you that, Hilda. But I can promise you one thing.
What?
From now on, and forever, Rumpo only descends.
In Rumpole for the Prosecution by John Mortimer, Horace Rumpole was played by Julian Reintutt, Mr. Fabian was Ewan Bailey, Ballard, Michael Cochran, and Hilda was Jasmine Hyde. Charmian was played by Deborah Finlay, Nicholas was Max Patterson, Judge Oliphant, Stephen Critchlow, Claude Erskine-Brown, Nigel Anthony, and Liz Probert was Amy Morgan. Other parts were played by members of the company. Rumpole for the Prosecution was adapted by Richard Stoneman, directed by Marilyn Imrie, and is a Catherine Bailey production for BBC Radio.